Hey everybody, this is Pierre Quinn, and you're listening to episode number 83 of the Leading While Green podcast, where my mission is to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. On this episode of the podcast, I am joined by Lewis Carter. Lewis is a CEO, a veteran consultant, an executive coach, and he is the author of the new book, In Great Company, How to Achieve Peak Performance by Creating an Emotionally Connected Workplace. We have a great conversation about the book, about Lewis's leadership journey, about why he started his own company, and about the five essential elements to emotional connection. We have a great conversation, so you want to take notes. Listen up. Once again, I want to thank you for supporting the Leading While Green podcast. You've done it with your reviews on Apple Podcast. You've done it with your shares on social media, with your text to let everyone know that a new episode is up. I just want to thank you so much for supporting the podcast. Your support means so much, and it's helping us take this message of effective leadership far and wide. Now, if you haven't hopped over to Apple Podcasts and left a five-star review and some comments, there's still time, and I want to encourage you to do that. Let other people know about the Leading While Green podcast. I also want to encourage you to hop over to prcquinn.com and take my free course, 12 Tips to Grow as a Leader. Great content that I'm giving away for free. I share this content with some of the leadership teams that I talk to across the country, and I'm going to put it in your hands for free. And you want to check that out at prcquinn.com. Also want to encourage you to check out my Leading While Green course. It's a bit deeper dive into leadership, and it's a great course. Tons of video content. Received some great feedback on the course and how much it's really helping leaders grow. It's really a companion guide to my Leading While Green book, and you want to check out that course and recommend it to the leaders that you work with. Okay, my guest today is Lewis Carter, and Lewis is the author of the new book, In Great Company, How to Achieve Peak Performance by Creating an Emotionally Connected Workplace. Lewis and I have a great conversation about his leadership journey and about really the catalyst behind starting his own company and how that company has grown over the years. He talks about the feeling of being at a job and just punching a clock and collecting a paycheck, and how when you get to that place, you're detrimental to yourself and to your team. He challenges leaders. He challenges those in charge to create an emotionally connected workplace. And we outline, where Lewis outlines, as I listen, the five key elements to creating emotional connection. We talk about some of the top companies in the world. We talk about some of his clients, and we talk about some advice for new MBAs and how not to take their education for granted. So here's my conversation with Lewis Carter. Excited to be joined on this episode of the Leading While Green podcast by Lewis Carter. Lewis is the CEO and president of the Best Practice Institute. He's a veteran consultant. He's an executive coach. He's a speaker, and he's the author of the new book, In Great Company, How to Spark Peak Performance by Creating an Emotionally Connected Workplace. Lewis, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Pierre. It's good to meet you.
So let's take it back a little bit. When was your interest in studying organizations, organizational development, culture, and leadership? When was it first sparked?
That's a good word, spark, because that's part of the book, actually, how to spark emotional connectedness. It was sparked when I just hated working for people who are jerks. That's what it came down to. That's how it all started. You know, a lot of authors will tell you, oh, I did tremendous amounts of research, which I did for this, and I learned these incredible things. And, you know, but the truth is, I got sparked when I worked for people who were just plain jerks and didn't want to really create a great culture for anybody, and were too busy, you know, in the probably the 90s hazing people and making everybody's lives a living hell. So I don't know if you remember those times, but, you know, it now isn't very different. People who say that they're disrespected and don't have their ideas heard are 98% more likely to cash their paychecks and make everybody's lives a living hell. It's not so good if they're making your cup of coffee in the morning. I'm just saying, you know, watch out for what you're sipping. And the other 2% actually leave. So, you know, so those are the only smart ones. So we did a study on it I for this book, and it's on something called emotional connectedness. This whole theory of EC is it's like the new emotional intelligence. EI is about being very, you know, empathetic and being very specific and emotionally regulated. I will not have an emotion. Well, EC is about you have your emotions, feel safe having an emotion. You're human. And we're not robots. Maybe there's a world of artificial intelligent robots one day, but for now, we're the ones who are winning.
So there's one thing to be. It's one thing to be tired of working at organizations where, you know, the leaders and influencers are jerks, and to seek maybe a different organization to work for. It's another thing to say, you know, I'm going to start my own organization. Give us some backstory into what led to founding the Best Practice Institute.
What's cool, it's interesting what happened with BPI, and because it really all happened when I was at Columbia. I was getting my graduate degree at Columbia University. And basically, you know, what had happened was, I'll give you the story. So at the first company I worked for, the owner locked me in the office to finish everybody else's work. Wow. And then he went off to party with my coworkers. And when I called him at 2 a.m. to be let out of the building, he was drunk. And I vowed that when I became a CEO, I'd never be like him. In 2001, I entered grad school at Columbia, and I almost overslept my first day of classes. Fortunately, I was awakened by the first plane hitting the towers. Mm. You know, what had happened at that time is, it's true. My first day of school, grad school, was 9/11. And how did I react to the attack? I did what any red-blooded, patriotic American would do. I started a drum circle at school. The drum circle turned out to be the right thing to do because people thought it was the end of the world, but I was feeling pretty good. And basically, after grad school, I was an unemployed drummer with no girlfriend, so I was homeless. So I decided to start my own company. Nobody's allowed. This isn't funny to you, I think, at this point. So I decided to start my own company, which is called BPI. Just talk about it. And sounds like something a little less interesting than BMI, your BMI. But anyways, I coach CEOs basically, and you talk about being green at BPI, and I did it because I took this concept of drum circle, and I said nobody's going to buy a drum circle who are executives, right?
Right.
They don't care about that, right? And I had done a lot of work, and I did a lot of books with some of the biggest players like Warren Bennis and Marshall Goldsmith, and mm-hmm. I had started a best practices research and said to myself, I've got to do something about this. So I went back to Pfizer and some of my friends there, and I said, hey, look, I need a job. Will you make me your director of leadership development? Then we got a good laugh together. He's not coming in here. He's not going to work for this company because no, Lou's doesn't work for companies. He works for himself and he helps others, creates experiences. I just don't work for a big company. I don't want to. I don't want to be a full-time employee for a big company. I like to work for all of them, as many as I possibly can, because I want to have as big as a reach as possible. So I said, well, how about we create a benchmark research consortium of people just like you, and we'll create great ideas and practices that are awesome for you and your company, and we'll do it with great people. So not only people who really do awesome work and who want to do the very best, but we'll do it with nice people, because I think there's two important things in the world. Number one is to do your job really well, but number two is to be a nice person. I think at the end of the day, when you're on your deathbed, that's the one thing you'll probably say to yourself, not how rich you were, not that when you get that BMW, you're going to say to yourself, am I nice to others? And I think at the end of the day, any person who's 90, 100 years old or less is somebody who's going on their way out would tell you that. It's not about giving back even. A lot of people get to realize that they don't doesn't really matter about the philanthropy they give or about how much money they have. It matters how nice they are. So that's important to us. So I created it, and he told Vovo, Boston Scientific, Bank of America. Before we knew it, you know, Walmart was on, and huge companies, and we were representing billions of employees worldwide through Benchmark Research Consortium. And the information that we were sharing with each other were all about how to transform organizations for people to become more peak performing and highly engaged through talent management. So we were creating a culture for ourselves, we were living it, and our companies that would change the way they interact, both on the floor if it's retail or if it's in the lab for pharmaceuticals, or if it's leaders who are developing others.
In your work in studying workplace culture over the years, and even shaping culture with your organization and the organizations that you work with in your research, it seems to be this shift in conversations about emotional intelligence, emotional connection, loving the work that you do, whereas sometimes history paints it that wasn't always the case. You just went to work, you did your job, you got paid, didn't matter if you didn't like it or not. That's just the way of the world. Do you find this to be an actual shift? And if so, why is it the case that we're focusing on this topic of emotional connection and workplace vulnerability and liking your work at this point in our society?
Well, I blame it all on hip hop. I'm kidding around in many ways. I don't. It's actually not. Hip hop has done a lot of amazing things for us. I don't know if you know what's happened in Thailand, but they're moving to a democracy now, and they've had dictators for many, many years. And they basically, in that movement to democracy, they're using hip hop as a lot of young people are using hip hop as a way of getting really they're upset about what's happening in these regimes, and they're expressing themselves. And for once, you know, millions of people are viewing it on YouTube, and the dictatorships are getting really mad at them. They're saying, no, we want control. We want to be jerks. Stop. We don't want you to have a voice, right? And by the way, don't feel safe speaking your mind. Because we're just going to go ahead and slap you down. So there's a movement around the world. I mean, not just Thailand. This is all over the world. This is happening in Europe and Africa and in Asia and in Middle Eastern countries. And in other regimes that are more totalitarian, more dictatorships. In America, they set the standard for free speech and freedom of speech and psychological safety. There's other ramifications for that, of course, may have happened in terms of societal shifts that are needed. I think there's a ubiquitous, all-encompassing movement around the world for people who really want to feel that connectedness, that sense of safety to be who they are and to express themselves and their innovations. And if they don't, if they're not allowed to, they're going to get angry. All right. That's just the bottom line. When you let people express themselves and be themselves and share with how they're feeling and how they want to connect to each other, you'll always win. If you treat people like a problem and you tell them they can't do something because you don't like what they're saying and it goes against the grain and it's not inculcated with culture, you're gonna win or lose. So you'll win some of them because they'll feel that sense of, you know, sort of functionality that I'm told what to do and I can do what I say, but you'll lose most of them who are really highly performing and potential inside of a company.
You suggest in your book that a good CEO, an effective CEO, will try to see things from the lens of a psychologist. Now, typically, when we think psychologists, you know, we think problem, we think, you know, mental illness, somebody needs to go sit on a couch and get some help. But why is it effective for a CEO to look from the vantage point of a psychologist when they're trying to create an emotionally connected workplace?
Yeah, you know, I read that point. I'd like to throw that point on its back for a second, and I'm going to explain why it's important not to look at it like a psychologist. I know that was written there, and I'm going to write back explain why it's not. So this is not about psychology and psychiatry. This is not about helping someone feel, you know, better about themselves or improving their lives. It's about changing behavior. Hmm. This is about changing the way you are in the world every day and being vigilant about it. So if you're going to be a CEO, a great CEO like Gary Ridge, who creates a tribal culture at WD-40, and he enables people to feel comfortable being themselves, and people pitch in when they need help, and they help each other, whether it be childcare or teamwork or whatever it may be at times of need, or if it's Patagonia in the way that they are very specific around their environmental policies, whoever the CEO is, you have to live that change every day. So if you're going to go out there and say you're a tribal culture, you better go in and be part of the tribe and actually do the work, you know, and you got to be collaborative. You got to spark, you know, that kind of respect for others and yourself. You have to really live that kind of change. And, you know, it's not about psychology or psychiatry. You know, it's about behavior change. So if I were to, if I were to subscribe or prescribe a psychology, I would say it's really applied behavioral therapy or ABT, applied behavioral psychology, you know, because it's really about, you know, doing things consistently each day that support a full culture of psychological safety. And, you know, I don't want CEOs to think of it like a psychologist, you know, from a psychologist perspective. I want to see it from a human perspective, a, you know, applied behavioral psychology perspective. So they're not thinking, I'm going to get fixed. I have something right. wrong in my life. I don't want them to think like that. Because if they think that they're going to be fixed and somebody else is going to do it, it's never going to happen.
Well, you mentioned this idea of collaborative culture and you know, working together in the areas that we need to help the most. What's the difference? Well, how would you define collaboration? And what's the difference between collaboration and then the emphasis on systemic collaboration that you outline in the book?
There is a difference, because I think here's what's happening with collaboration. People are getting really angry at just collaboration lately. I don't want to just collaborate. I don't want to just every time go out there and discuss and develop and co-create every single time. I want to be able to be an independent contributor, right? So that's important that we recognize that there is a difference between collaboration and systemic collaboration. Systemic collaboration is I can be an independent contributor and I could do my work. I can get coaching to do better. And at the same time, when I walk into a meeting or I present my work, I'll know that there are different ways of being in that environment. And what I mean by that is, you know, somebody's going to challenge me. Somebody may support me. Someone may mirror and understand me. Someone may move to a conclusion, and it may be out of my control after I've done my work. Others may shoot my idea down. Some people may support my idea. Some people may, you know, move to a conclusion on that support or challenge. And you could defend all you want. However, if you're not collaborative and understand its role inside of the company and that team, you're missing out on a larger vision. Because in order to be really psychologically safe inside a company, meaning in order to excel and succeed inside of a company, you have to be aware that you're working with other people, you're collaborating with other people, and what you do doesn't always have to be what will happen.
Hmm. When we're looking at working in these collaborative environments, sometimes we are challenged when our idea is not supported, when it's shot down, or maybe people come to a conclusion about us that might not be the conclusion that we were trying to put out there. Why is it important to, you know, remain positive? And what's the impact of positivity on on creativity, on collaboration, on the health and viability of the workplace?
You know, a lot of this comes down to, you've ever been, you know, with people that you really know and trust, and they can work through with you on anything. And even if when you kind of, you hash it out or spar it out, and you come to the right conclusion that is understandable to both of you, and you kind of mm-hmm. laugh about it, and you release the tension in that situation, right? So, I mean, it happened, you know, yesterday. I was on a team meeting Sunday, and we were talking about, a specific business plan that we're developing. And I said, look, there's no way that I could talk about your target market, because, first of all, you know more about your target market. And if you want someone to go look on the web to research your target market, then you're going to look for a really lousy person who's just going to give you lousy work. But you're working with someone like me who likes to create and collaborate with you because you know better than anyone else. So, and I'm like, and I think you better get off your high horse and stop being such a jerk. So so I really said that to this kid. So, and like, there was silence, either that or he put it on mute. I don't know which one it was, but total silence, right, on the conversation. And then like, we keep going. And we keep talking, and the other guy was talking on the phone about his stuff. And then, all of a sudden we come back and I say, so now do you get it? He's like, yeah, Lou, I really appreciate when you call me on the carpet every single time. I'm like, yeah, you should, because that's exactly what you need. So, and we joked about it and we laughed, there's something really great about being yourself and that being the definition of positivity. Because when I was on the phone someone might say, oh, he's negative, he's saying bad things about that. No, I'm not being negative. I'm being really honest. I love the guy. We've been friends for 15 years. We're in a business now together. We run it together. I know that if I don't hash it out and spar it out with him, we're not going to get anywhere. So at times he needs to be put in his place. That may not be seen as positivity and fluffy, but he needs to be slapped. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, mm-hmm. that sometimes positivity is about, literally saying what you need to say in the way that that person needs to hear it and stopping them in their tracks. So, and if you don't have that level of honesty and safety to do that, you're probably in a really bad environment. So I, the way I look at it is that, we have to place our assumptions on the table, our perceptions on the table, and let people read them the way they need to read them. So put your story on the table, put your words on the table, put who you are on the table and what you see, and let others come back, tell you what they really think, give you their perception. If they don't like it, say it. People need to feel more comfortable being honest. That's positivity.
Well, you just mentioned this idea of honesty, and in many organizations, honesty is a core value. When you're working with organizations, how do you help them, if they're not clear, discover what their core values are? And then how do you help them align the entire company around that particular set of values?
One person at a time, one buddy group at a time, one triad at a time, and one team at a time. So, everything starts in community. All right. So I'll give you an example. Okay. This is an overarching kind of societal marketing example. I always look at it in terms of marketing consumer behavior. How are you going to get a group of dance workshop owners together? Okay, so you're going to, we find your favorite steakhouse. You say, okay, hello, Chicago dance workshop owners. We're going to go to the best steakhouse in Chicago. Lowry's is a really great one. And we're going to talk about the State of the Union about dance workshops and what they're doing. And after that, what we're going to do is we're going to really dig into what we need to do to be better in profit, to develop our workshops a little better, and just be great in Chicago. So similarly, within cultures inside of companies, we do that by starting with our spark questions and statements, and they come together around what they really want to accomplish. So it's not just coming together to come together. It's about coming together to accomplish X, Y, Z, And you're bringing them together in a comfortable, safe environment and saying, we know what you want already. We know what you need to do. And we know why you're here. And they say, okay, boom, you're in dyads. Talk about, how do I collaborate systemically? What do I do to collaborate? How do I create a positive future? You just talked about it. How do I align values? How to respect, be respected? And finally, how do I create outcomes that are good for myself and the company? And then you introduce each other. So now you're creating a community that in everything you do from onboarding all the way through to performance management. So the creation of a culture is very slow. It has to happen every day. You have to do it in many ways, and you have to create that consistent way of always staying into your creating your spark among people.
Let's go back to the conversation that you were having with a buddy of yours. You've been buddies for 15 years, and you were having this dialogue, and you were calling him on the carpet and pointing out some things to him. You know, how is that, doing that for your friend and your colleague, someone you're in business with, why is that an important part of defining what respect is, and versus letting someone just kind of go and make a mess of things because you don't want to say anything? But really, when you look at it, that's disrespectful. So why is saying things as you see them and facing the hard situations an important part of creating a culture of respect?
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yep. So you know what I mean. You've been there.
Yeah.
So, I get it. So, this is the 98% of people who stay and make your life a living hell and cash your paycheck. They're the ones that disrespect others by not telling them what they really think, because you're not going to get to a better place if you don't. It's just it. So if they're going someplace that they shouldn't, or if they are going to not succeed by doing something, I mean, look at, in terms of police officers, you know, are you going to let your partner, if you're a police officer, go out and start shooting with 20 perpetrators out there? No, calm down, wait for backup, right? Mm-hmm. Or look at your situation, have situational awareness. It's the same way. I'm not going to let him talk about things or have a better perception of what your reality really is. Check yourself. So you have to, police officers need to check themselves first. They don't do that enough. We don't look at our perceptions enough, right? We don't. And same thing with Ed. He didn't look at his perception enough. So I would have just let him out there. He would have, guns a-blazing or people blazing at him. And he would have been like the Wild West. He would have screwed everything up. And he does that over and over and over again. So I have to keep stopping and stopping and stopping him. And then finally, I know he wants to change, because he's willing to change. He wants to change. I coach him on change. So that's the reason why I keep it up with him, is because he stops and he restarts. So same thing needs to happen in public servants, within entrepreneurial nature, same thing everywhere. We have to check ourselves. We have to be checked by others, have accountability for what we do. Otherwise, this whole society is going to get even worse and worse. We're not going to improve.
Speak to maybe our just recent college graduates, you know, young MBAs fresh out of school, you know, head full of knowledge, ready to go. And what's the necessity of being, you know, maybe if you've gone to a top school, had a great internship, tons of reviews and recommendations. So maybe you come into your organization with a certain perspective. What's the importance of being teachable, of being able to be coached and counseled, being able to take critique and criticism in the growth and maturity of a CEO or a top leader?
Awesome question. Okay. Yeah. So I do have some advice for some recent MBAs. I know different MBAs, different kinds of MBAs. There's a lot of great people who are ready to be, you know, have leadership agility, who take feedback and feed forward and who are coachable. Mm-hmm. There are others, though, who are not quite as coachable. And I don't know if they're listening to this podcast, but I hope you are, because I do have some advice for you. One thing is very important. There are CEOs who I've coached who are at the top level. So they're top level. Now, they work for people who are much more powerful and richer than they are. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? They own them. Mm-hmm. All right. So I just want to tell everybody out there right now, if you're going to be a career CEO, you're not, it's not your name. Okay. It's your name is CEO. It's not your name. You don't exist. The CEO position exists. Duncan Niederauer, who is the former CEO of New York Stock Exchange, knew very well it wasn't about Duncan Niederauer. It was about CEO of New York Stock Exchange. You have a role to play.
That's good. Just like,
absolutely. I mean, you, whether you're the head of a Broadway musical or you're the CEO of New York Stock Exchange, it's about you're playing a role. It's important for people. So you know, some of the worst CEOs don't understand that and say, just listen to me. Oh, the board tells them to do things and they don't like it. Or the owner tells them to do things and they don't like it. Guess what? The people who own the company are the people in power and make the decisions, make peace with it. Sorry, you just signed your life away to be CEO of a company. So you have to do what they say. They're your bosses, whether you like it or not. They're your bosses. And that's why CEO tenure is so short. So there's not a lot of time. The very low tenure CEOs. It's tenure for CEO founders is much higher. Mm-hmm. They stay on the board. They understand the foundation of the company. They love the company most likely. And they also created the culture in the beginning. Numerous CEOs who've done that, who've been, I mean, from Gates to Nardelli, Bernie Marcus, Bill Gates, of course, the great Steve Jobs, Reed Hastings, Elon Musk. These are, in my view, the most fantastic, incredible CEOs in the world because they founded and were entrepreneurial about what they're creating and have built empires. The people who succeed them, though, could easily become power hungry. And it's happened too much. And what they do is they take over, they don't listen as much, they're not as allegiant to the founding cultural elements, for maybe sometimes for a reason, because they've asked to cut costs. However, let me just tell you right now, young MBAs, just because you got a degree from Harvard or Stanford or Kellogg doesn't make you awesome, or Princeton doesn't make you awesome, okay? It just makes you someone who got an MBA from one of those Ivy League institutions. That's it. Okay? The hard work happens now. Be coachable. Be agile. Understand that there are things greater than yourself that occur in life. There's a lot of bigger things than ourselves. There's astronauts who prove that.
Yeah.
So check it first. Check yourself, because there's something greater than you as a force. And take it easy. Don't go so fast. You're young. You have a long time ahead of you to build your nest egg and create your life. Calm down. Don't be so crazy about what you're doing. Let the world be at peace with what you're doing and bring the goodness that your founders and owners brought to the world.
Last piece I want to get to, Lewis, before we run out of time, is the importance of creating a culture of killer achievement. You know, we got companies like Netflix and Best Buy who create these awesome outcomes. How do you define killer achievement, and why is it important for our great company culture that we're trying to build?
Why is killer achievement important? Is that what you had mentioned? Is that what you said? So, because if you don't achieve, you can't succeed together, right? I mean, mm-hmm. This is, by the way, what I'm talking about with founders and owners it's only with the good ones. I'm not talking about mean people who created horrible dictatorships and societies that harm other people or take away their freedoms. I'm talking about people that create, you know, enormous outcomes for the world that make things better. I mean, they re-exist, by the way, for the very reason that the company itself is connected to those outcomes. Whole Foods creating an outcome that enables people to eat better, being more green, being more environmentally conscious. Tata Energy creating more sustainable social responsible outcomes. Companies that are dedicated to creating more equality among workers that increase diversity, that increase gender diversity, there's phenomenal companies out there that do great things. And I'm saying to those CEOs right now is that be mindful of the great things that they've done and don't cut those down. Okay, I want to be clear about that. Okay, mm-hmm. Because some people may say, well, you know, pay homage to founders that are owners who have hurt us and don't change the regime. No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying don't create a horrible regime that wasn't a part of the greatness and goodness that defined the company before. That's what I'm really saying. And I want to be very careful, as I don't know if I brought that through very, you know, clearly before. I think it may have, because I want people to know that, like you said in your podcast, it's about green, right? This your podcast is about creating great things in the world, isn't it? Mm-hmm. With through leadership. Isn't that what, tell me more about it. You really want to make great things happen in the world, right? You want, right? I'm sure you have a purpose behind what you're doing. That's part of outcomes. Tell me about the outcomes you want in the world. Tell me for you.
Yeah, I come from the place of being in a chair of responsibility and having no idea at a certain time what I was supposed to be doing. And then as I move forward in my career, seeing myself in younger leaders floundering, frustrated, overwhelmed, and saying, you know, one leader at a time, one conversation at a time, I want to help young emerging leaders get over the hump like I was able to get over the hump so they can be great influencers where they live, work, and play. And that's really been my life and heart's mission for the past several years of helping these young people, inexperienced, you know, fresh ideas, new chances, really make an incredible difference in the world.
Awesome. See, that's what I'm talking about. What you just said is what it's all about. That's the killer outcome right there. Hmm. Right there. You're a founder. You're a founder mentality. And that's a founder mentality killer outcome. You just said it all.
Lewis, what keeps you going? What keeps you getting on planes, on conference calls, in meetings, eating at steakhouses? What keeps you excited about the work that you do?
That was hilarious. I only eat steak maybe once a month, but it's not you, man. You're what you just said. It's all about what you just said. The fact that I can think back to the times I was locked out of my office or the times when I've seen others be disenfranchised or, you know, high school when you see kids who are mean to others or my company too, when I see people loafing, social loafing, and not doing the work they should be doing to help the company. And I'm thinking to myself, geez, this stuff can happen on a mass scale. Like, you know, you think about billions of people and millions of employees who are just standing there, not connecting, and they hate the place they're working, and they're just waiting for that paycheck to get cash, and they're hurting everyone. They're not just hurting themselves and their families, they're hurting other families. You know, they're hurting society. They're hurting the economics of society. And they're hurting the fabric of how we interact and connect as human beings. We got to stop that really quickly. That's what keeps me going.
Where can we get the book and learn more about your work at Best Practice Institute and the things that keep you going? Where can we find you?
I'd love for you to get the book. It's an awesome book. There's great examples, cases, theories, all my research is in there. So you can go to lewiscarter.com. It's Lewis, L-O-U-I-S, Carter, C-A-R-T-E-R.com, lewiscarter.com. You find the book there, or go to bestpracticeinstitute.org. That's a little bit other stuff that I do in my company. And it's at Barnes & Noble. It's on Amazon.com. You can go anywhere you want for it. And I really hope you get it. I really hope you get it. It's an awesome book. And I'm not just saying that because I wrote it. I was rereading it the other day. I was like, oh, there's a lot of powerful stuff in here. You just gotta read it. And yeah, it's really good.
My guest today has been Lewis Carter, the CEO and president of Best Practice Institute and the author of the new book, In Great Company, How to Spark Peak Performance by Creating an Emotionally Connected Workplace. Lewis, thanks for being my guest today.
Hey, thank you for having me. You're a really great guy. Thank you so much.
Great conversation with Lewis Carter about his book, In Great Company. Now, I want you to go out and get your own copy of In Great Company, and you can find out more about his book at lewiscarter.com. We put some links in the show notes as well, so you can find out more about the Best Practice Institute and what Lewis and his team is doing to grow leaders. Well, you know it's my mission to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. So hop over to Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star review and some comments. Let other people know about the Leading While Green podcast. That's all I got for this episode. So until next time, take care and God bless.